This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
Pressed by Torres, the set, the kick, and the pitch. It's deep to left field. This one may be off the wall, maybe in the screen.
Lang and Chernyshev on top as expected. They're eligible for Salt Lake City.
Indian All-Star.
All right.
Okay. So I'm here. It's my honor this morning to talk with the fastest Indian alive, one and only Ross Anderson. Welcome to
Good morning.
Indian All-Star.
Good morning.
It's great to connect with you.
Definitely good. I appreciate you having me. Definitely an honor, and it's you know, for the time that you spent on my stuff and, you know, connecting with you, you know, definitely looking forward to what you have and what I can tell.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, I mean, I know a bit about you because I've obviously been following you a bit, and but tell us a little bit about who you are, and why Indian All-Star should interview you.
Well, who I am? Yeah. I grew up in Durango. That's where I learned how to ski, basically, when I was 3 years old. At three, started racing since I was six. From six, I did giant slalom, downhill. You know, definitely most of my upbringing, and did a couple other events, but basically that was my format. So I knew racing for a long time. And from there, I kind of took off when I was 18. I actually did a little bit of the pro ski tour for GS and slalom before I did speed skiing.
Okay.
Speed skiing was in the Olympics in 92 as a demonstration sport. And I knew speed skiing before that because I was living in Durango. You're close to Silverton, Colorado. And that's where they used to have speed skiing before I even knew what it was. And so that got me hooked just to see, because it was so neat what they looked like, you know, the aerodynamic helmets, the speed suits were so, you know, they looked like a rubber, you know, it was really shiny on you, and these big old fairings behind your calves. So you know, it was just extreme look of what it looked like. And I've always, you know, wanted to see what it was like to eventually go into it, but you know, I didn't think I was going to actually do it back then. And then I had a friend in 92. His name's Dale Womack. He was in the Olympics for the 92 in Albertville, France. And he introduced it to me. I raced with him on my upbringing. He was in college and I was in, you know, on the resort ski team. We shared a big old shed, like wax room, with the college and us. So we got to train together, and they were kind of like the mentors back then. But anyways, he said, you know, you need to try this, you know, you're fast and I think you'll like it. And I said, okay. So from there, basically at 22 years old, I drove. At that time, I lived in Denver, Colorado. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to go for it. There's a qualification over in Tahoe Donner, California. And I thought about it. And I said, okay. That day before, I went to the pawn shop, got a motorcycle helmet. Didn't know really anything about it. I just knew I had to get, you know, something that would be protective. Got a old downhill suit and an old pair of downhill skis. Drove all night long until about 7 o'clock in the morning. Got there, no sleep whatsoever. Ooh. I registered for the event that day. It was snowing like crazy, but I went ahead and raced or trained there that day, and it was like a 2-day event. And basically that second day, I qualified for the North American Championships. And so then I was able to utilize that to get some funds going so I can go to Europe that next year. And I think I only did one race that first year, but it was in Les Arcs, France. And that's when I, you know, started getting the good stuff, the suits, the helmet and whatnot. Yeah. It's all secondhand during that time. But from there, I just kept going. And 18 years later, being on the U.S. Speed ski team, I made a full career of it. And not only that, and broke the All-American record during that time.
Wow. I love that. Kid from a little town. I've been, well, it's medium sized town, Durango. I like that. That's a good town, by the way. Coming from there, and then with a whole bunch of secondhand gear, on a whim, you go, and dang if you don't qualify. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you. So. And you know the other.
Oh, go ahead.
The other thing is, you know, when it came to skiing itself, the winter sport itself, when we're growing up, Durango is very percentage-wise, you don't see much of any color out there. Just, you know, no natives, no really anybody of color. And Durango, and even in the sport of skiing itself, it's very rare. And so that was one of the things when I was growing up, it's like, I have to do something, you know, I need to do something. When I was getting older, I was like, you know what? I'm going to qualify. I'm going to be part of the team. I'm going to be on the USK team. I'm going to represent, and I'm going to make sure that people know I was native. And people knew that I wanted people to know that anybody can do this.
That is so awesome.
And it was just a seed like a tree. And, you know, when you get that hard foundation, then things start growing, you know, left and right branches. And so the branches for me were, you know, the kids programs, the community services, the public speaking, anything I was able to do to spread the word out and let definitely the next generation that, you know, don't give up no matter what. And so when I have my helmet was like my trademark for representing all indigenous. And that was from the very beginning. I designed the artwork from the get-go to what it is now. And so I actually brought my helmet.
Excellent.
So
that's the coolest thing.
Yeah.
Look at that. That is so awesome. And
so
man, it looks fast
really, really. What's that?
It looks fast just sitting there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we are. We went far. I had three helmets, actually, like this. You know, this is my middle one. This, it went 148 miles per hour. And then my fastest one is 154.06 miles per hour, which is all the All American record as well.
Yeah, that is crazy fast. So I got to ask you about that.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, for those of us who have never gone that fast, not even in a car, can you tell us, what does it feel like? I mean, can you feel the speed, or are you just concentrating on straight line, or how do, what's going through your mind as you're going down the hill?
You know, definitely a lot of wind pressure. I mean, intense wind pressure that can rip you apart. When I actually did that run, I was so in tune with myself, so in the zone, you call it, mm-hmm. where things are slower than they really are. When I was at the finals during that time, I was so in the zone, so complete that everything was right. Everything was, the weather was perfect. You know, it was only the top 15 got to be at the very, very top. It was over a mile long course, 65% pitch. And if you look from the top to the bottom at the finish line, you see these dots. Those are people. I mean, it's bunches of people, but I mean, you couldn't identify them, of course, because it was so far. And I know I was in the zone because I was at the start, and that was the first time I was comfortable enough to say, you know, I kind of want to look around. I want to see, you know, people's reaction. I want to hear the helicopters and all that, because they're, you know, helicopters are whirling around with the camera waiting for you and whatnot. And I wanted to listen, but I couldn't because I was in that zone that it wouldn't let me. Yeah. So it was weird because I saw people, but then at the same time, I didn't hear anything, nothing whatsoever. So when I hit that run and then he said, go, I went, got my tuck, and then went all the way down. Literally, I could fix all my drag work. Everything that would slow me down, I was able to fix it because it was a lot slower in my head that I was able just to nudge, just things that make sense that that nobody else would do, especially in that type of high level of a run. And so I was able to do that. And it was the coolest thing ever because you could tell where your drags were. It's like putting your hand out of the window and either keep it flat, you know, flat, yeah. or like that. And you can feel the pressure like that, or you can let it go through. And so that's what I did until about three quarters of that run. And I got a little air pocket, so it made me jump up a little bit like that. What happens is I was like this, and then the wind got in between my stomach right there. And the rest of that time, I had hold it. I mean, it was so intense. It was like ripping your apart. But I held it. And I remember in my helmet, I was just, you know, a loud, like a roar, just holding it. Ah, you know, holding it. And I hit the finish line. When I hit the finish line, I was like, oh, man, I ruined it. I can't believe I did that, you know. Just was getting down to myself because I knew I had that run. But it was that very end that I thought, we'll see what I get. So on the Jumbotron, the speed, you see from a distance, it said 2.4, and I thought it said 0 or 1 or something. I wasn't sure. But and this is kilometers per hour. Mm-hmm. So I looked at it. I said, well, at least I get maybe 150. Or, yeah, 150. That's cool, you know. And I got closer to the Jumbotron. It says 247.93, and that's 154.06 miles per hour. And I couldn't believe I just broke the national record. I had to wait for three other people in order to make it official, because a former All-American record holder was there too. So he competed at the same time I did, and he got 146, so he got 153 at that event. And so that record stands for 17 years now, going on April.
That's amazing. Yeah. That is so cool.
Yeah.
So are you bored driving a car now because it's slow?
I enjoy driving now. I'm safe now. I've done what I did, and it's nice to, you know, really tell the stories now that I'm able to, and you know, give some advice, and hopefully that next person, next leader, next doctor, next anybody, kind of gets some hope that you know, doesn't matter where it is, you're gonna, you know, complete it and be very successful at it.
Yeah, whatever your dream is.
It is. Yep.
So, yep. Have you, in all the time that you've been involved with this, have you seen any other native ski people coming in? I mean, because it's like you said, it is kind of a rarity.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up skiing here in Washington, and not many other Indian kids up there. And
right.
And it's kind of too bad. I mean, I guess recreational skiing is kind of a, you know, costly thing, and that might be an impact, I guess. But
yeah,
I mean, the gear costs some money, so.
It does. I mean, that's why I developed some of those programs. I had the youth programs. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a program in Durango that PBS actually aired, and it was really nice because, you know, that was national exposure. I had a French and Swiss magazine. They flew all the way to see this, my youth program. And these are kids from Oklahoma, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and a lot of them never even stepped foot on the mountain before or even seen the mountain before. And so watching them come from, especially from Oklahoma, from the Cheyenne Arapaho tribe, they'd never seen mountains before in their life. And so when they came and saw it, they, you know, the oohs and ahs of the eyes and the mouth open, and they just couldn't believe it. But then on top of that, they were going to actually ski down that mountain. So, you know, I had this, the instructors for Purgatory help out with this program. You know, they donated their time. They wanted to make sure this, you know, that they were able to see the youth really, you know, get a kick out of it and learn something and see something different. To me, I called it the mini a European vacation, where you're going somewhere so foreign, so different, but yet you'll get a lot out of it. And hopefully that will stay in their heads to know that if they can go down a mountain, then they can follow their dreams too. So that was a big thing on that. But it was really neat to see that. And I think I had 81 youth that did that program that year. And it was a weekend event, and, you know, the Durango community was involved. I had the hotel rooms, you know, donate some room. I mean, everything was, you know, really, really beneficial for everybody. That's, you know, it was really so fun. Cool.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
Boy, I would love to be there to see the magic on the kids' faces. What I'm imagining from you describing it is just phenomenal.
Yes, it was. And hopefully, you know, I'll start back up this, you know, some ski programs again and go from there. But, you know, it's always going to be there. So, I mean, I always want to do it. I always want to try to do what I can to help others as well.
So, and this isn't to put you on the spot or anything, this is just to ask, what does it take to put something together like that? I mean, what is the, it would seem like it could end up being an ongoing thing, but there's all kinds of costs involved and all that kind of stuff, I know, but just from the organizational standpoint, how could people out in the world, somebody like me, for instance, how could we help that effort? Because I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just need to go down get nitty gritty with the ski area or the place that you want to host the event, and get with them, allocate, you know, obviously some side funds, and then from there just work with the community and, you know, see what you're able to do. When I first did it, that's what I did. I mm-hmm. talked to the marketing manager over there and I said, hey, you know, I think this would be a great idea. I'm here. I'm the ambassador for the ski area. Let's do a ski program. Let's see, you know, see how it goes. And the first ski program I did, I had like 8 kids. And the following year I had 20. And then the third year I had 80. So, you know, it grows. Yeah. And it was really, really fun. But, you know, having the tribes be part of it, you know, they definitely helped out. You know, they have kids programs that they can utilize, and you have the ski area, you know, the format of the whole event, and the community itself, and depending on how far they're coming from or whatever, you know, that's what I did. I went to every hotel, every business, every, you know, place that I thought would able to help, you know, even just if it was just some money, that's fine. Because that's actually going to go towards the kids, and that's including all their rentals, their lift tickets, if they needed clothes, you name it. So
that's really cool.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Kudos to you for that, because you better change those kids' lives. Definitely gave them a whole right. new perspective on what the world looks like. So that's actually.
Yeah. Thank you.
So. What are you doing these days? You're not going 154 miles an hour, but
no,
skiing a lot just for fun, and or
no, I took 8 years off skiing because I was burned out, basically. Okay. You do it a lot that sometimes you got to take the break, and sure. I got into golf more. Really enjoyed the golfing because it's still kind of a mental sport. And so it's nice just to keep exercising and just being out in, you know, the beautiful Mother Nature, you know, that has to offer. Mm-hmm. And I do that, and I do public events. Right now I'm working on Hall of Fame. I just got inducted to the Hall of Fame for the Indigenous Athletic. And so that was really, really, it's such an honor just to be nominated, but being inducted. Mm-hmm. Now that's my first time. So I have that. I have, I also am working on New Mexico, Colorado, and the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame as well. Now U.S. Ski Hall of Snowboard Hall of Fame, I'm in the finals for this year. I went and resubmitted my application last year. They voted me in, which means is I don't have to worry about getting in it. I'm already in it. Now they just, the judges have to vote for me to be part of it. Okay. The process basically goes from 90 athletes from all over the United States. And that's including Olympians, any sport, really, downhill, slalom, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, and you know, a lot of these people's got gold and everything that goes with it. And so my name's part of that hat. When it's finally done, there's only 5 that are able to get nominated or get inducted. And so that's my hope for next year. We'll see.
Wow. So, well, we'll be keeping an eye on that. So who, excuse me, who are some of the people that are already in that you'll be joining? What's that club look like?
It's the for me it was like going to a candy store for me, because I you know, you have big name athletes, you know, but again, you know, like Steve and Phil Mayer, Bill yeah. Johnson, you have Bodie Miller, who just got inducted last night. Yeah, and another speed skier, his name is CJ Mueller, he's getting inducted today or tonight at the ceremony over at Big Sky, Montana. So that's what's going on over there.
Okay.
But one thing, you know, that, and I hope it all happens, is I would be the first indigenous ever to be in the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame, no matter what. So it'll be big news when that happens. And I look forward to doing that by sharing that and definitely go out more and being more in the community and really set an example and take that award and really, you know, spread it around.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we're rooting for you on that. It'll be a,
thank you.
It'll be excellent when it happens.
Yeah, that'll be fun. I did a commercial last year, or this year actually. We filmed last year. It aired nationally. It was a 30-second commercial for the New Mexico tourism, and it showed all over. And it was really neat. I didn't, you know, when we first talked, I didn't think it was. I thought it was going to be part of a commercial, you know, like a little 3-second part, whatever. Yeah. But I did not realize they were going to actually spotlight the commercial on me, and it was really well done. That they had a little boy actor as me when I was little, uh-huh. a little skier, and they had the storyline basically goes to my upbringing as I was small to where I'm at now to the fastest American ever. Uh-huh. So really, really cool. It's on YouTube. So I also need that link.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. So that was fun. And then upcoming in May, I'll be the speaker for the graduation class of Mescalero High School, and I'll be their keynote speaker for them. So
excellent.
I'm working on that right now. So that's pretty neat.
Keep inspiring, right? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So good stuff coming up.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So here's another on the spot question for you. What's one of the funniest things that happened when you were competing?
So I'm glad you brought that up. Because when I first went on the circuit, and that was in the very beginning, and going to Europe. Now, Europe really, really admires indigenous, the Native American culture.
Yes.
They have books in basically in every house. And, you know, I didn't ever realize that until I got over there. Well, when I got over there, people were just staring at me. Because I wasn't sure why they're staring at me, but kind of knew, but wasn't really sure. So finally somebody came up, and it was after the race that I did, and I was just packing up all my stuff, and it was a mom and a little kid, and the mom came over, and she's like, my son wants to know where your horse is. Says, my horse. Said, yeah, where's your horse and bow and arrow? I said, and I start laughing. It's like, it's down at the bottom of the hill. That's all I can say, just to make them smile. But they, you know, they've never seen a Native American, especially on skis, doing an actual pro event, but they see it in the books, and that's all they know so much. So they still think today, well, back then, that we still live in teepees and ride horses and
right.
hunt with bow and arrows. And,
yep.
and that was it. So, yeah.
That's funny, the different perceptions of it, right? Because that really is a pretty strong belief over there. That's still the case.
Yeah.
yeah. All right. That's a great story.
Thank you.
Somewhere, I don't know, maybe I read it, maybe it was on Facebook or something. You were talking about another guy from up here, from Tulalip. I've forgotten his name. Stu Young, is that it?
Yeah, Stu Young Sr. He's from the Tulu tribe. He was actually, he speed skied before I was. And then there was a little time that we actually skied together. And that kind of what developed the fastest Native American on Mother Earth record, because he obviously had it, but didn't realize that I was coming on. And then I came on, and that's where that record came from, is from him and I. And, but he was a little older than I was. And basically, you know, he taught me a few things here and there in the beginning, but yeah, it was nice to represent him and myself over in Europe. We had a huge spotlight on a article, a newspaper over there. And, you know, even though we were middle of the pack, they pay more attention to us than the winners that actually won the race, because they want to know who we were and respected everything that we'd done. And so it was fun.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
So one more question, and then I'll let you go hit the slopes. Who is your biggest inspiration or motivation? What person was that for you?
Well,
it could be related to skiing, your life, professional, whatever. Just an impact on you.
When growing up, I really didn't have really anybody to look up to. I mean, I liked, you know, Alberto Tomba back then, and he was a Italian.
Right.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. I don't know what happened. I think it would mess with my earpiece. Because I didn't want to answer that question. No, I was kidding.
You could just say pass.
Yeah. I think the inspiration that I got, the people that inspired me, are the ones that did their goals. Billy Mills doing his run, Jim Thorpe doing what he did. You know, I know they're way back, but they also still inspire us today. The athletes that achieved something so high, and really did something with it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, you know, break a record and brag about it and do nothing with it. But it's the people that actually do something, but then also reach out more to the community. So that's my inspiration.
That's great.
Then that's how, what it was. And like I said before, you know, the reason why I achieved skiing is because I wanted to make a difference and out there. And not only making a difference, just being on the pro circuit, but also owning a record that's always been held by other skiers, not a Native American.
Right.
And so it's kind of neat to see this long list of all the other skiers who own that record, but yet I'm there representing all the indigenous at the same time.
Yes. Yep. That is that's really, really cool. And you know, that's part of why I'm doing this whole Indian All-Stars thing, is that kids on the res everywhere need to know that story, need to know that you came from just like that and achieved this great stuff, right? I mean, it's possible. Keep that, whatever that dream is, keep that dream, because you can do it. And that's that's a good message that you're continuing to spread. And so I'll help you out with that.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
No, it's been great talking with you. I appreciate you taking the time, and I look forward to maybe catching up with you again down the road a little bit.
That sounds good. And I'll keep you up to date on any things I do too. Yeah,
please, please let me know. And good luck with the Hall of Fame stuff. I'm sure it's a done deal. And we'll celebrate with you.
Thank you so much.
All right, Ross. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
We'll see you.
Okay.
Yeah. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.